We will call to order the Borough Assembly meeting for September 17th, 2018. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Member Merle?
Here.
Member Castro?
He is excused.
Member Stanton Brecher?
Here.
Member Wolfhuter?
Here.
Member Strand?
Here, yes.
Mayor Jensen?
Mayor Jensen is excused.
Member
Nucci? Here.
All right. And just for those listening at home, we have Kurt calling in telephonically. With that, let's all rise for the voluntary pledge.
Pledge
I would entertain a motion to approve the September 4th, 2018 regular meeting minutes.
So moved.
Second.
Been moved by Member Amici and seconded by Member Moral. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Minutes are passed unanimously. And at this point, I'd either entertain a motion to approve the agenda or to amend it. Member Amici.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'd just like to add my short report on my attendance to Southeast Conference last week.
Sounds good. Is there any place where we put that?
How about 17, under discussion item 17, whatever,
yeah.
C, after.
Yeah. Rules.
Whatever works for you guys.
I guess since that'd be in the form of a motion, I suppose. Is there a second for that?
Second.
Cool. It's been moved by Member Amici, seconded by Member Strand. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
No opposed. Now we will vote on the meeting as amended.
So, Mr. Mayor.
Yes.
I have a question.
Of course.
So we have, a report from Trey regarding SEPA.
Yes, sir.
And so do we need to add anything about water levels and stuff, or it's all part of the same report?
Well, how about we play it as it comes when as this presentation goes on?
Sure.
We'll allow ourselves that flexibility.
Yep, that sounds great.
All right.
Thank you.
So the agenda as amended, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. The meeting passes as amended with Jeff giving a Southeast Conference update under Assembly Discussion Item C. And that brings us to public hearings, which there are none. And there are no bid awards. That brings us to visitors' views related to the agenda. Would anybody here this evening like to speak on visitors' views related to the agenda? Seeing none. Anybody like to speak on visitors' views unrelated to the agenda? No? All right. Board, commission, and committee reports. None there. The consent agenda. Clerk Thompson requests approval for lease amendment number 5 for Weekend Enterprises at a rate of $4,032 per year through September 14th, 2022.
So moved.
Second.
All right. It's been moved by Member Amici, seconded by Member Strand. Any discussion? Actually, no, it's consent agenda item. No discussion. Will the clerk call the roll?
Member Wolfhuter?
Yes.
Member Amici?
Yes.
Yes.
Member Merle?
Yes.
Member Stanton Greger?
Yes. And it passes unanimously. And with that, SEPA CEO Trey Acteson will give us an update on current SEPA activities. It's all you, Trey, and thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to try to resituate it just a little bit different, if I may.
You bet.
I'm going to grab this over here so you guys can see, and then I can advance my slides as well. Well, it doesn't help to have that front, does it?
I'm going to go around this other side.
Put that microphone down. You could sit down there. How about?
That is a good solution.
Maybe.
Maybe set it right there, you think, Joe?
Just can't block that.
Yeah. There we go.
Good solution.
All right, thanks. Can everybody hear me okay?
Clearly.
However, the podium is kind of blocking part of the screen.
Still is. Let me move that.
Okay, I'll move it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay,
all right.
Good.
I'll get a roll.
Cool.
Good to be back here again in Petersburg, and just try to get around to get some face-to-face time with the assemblies and councils of our three-member utilities. And so it's kind of nice. Got a little bit of time tonight. Not super rushed, so I'll spend a little extra time. And feel free to stop me anytime if you have questions. I'll go into lake levels a little bit. I'll talk about some of the new activities we have going. And hopefully I got a few new pictures that I just received like half hour ago and loaded them up for an ROV inspection. So hopefully you guys enjoy that as well. I won't spend too much time on this. I always like to just give a general overview for folks that might be listening, not familiar with our organization. We're a wholesale power provider for Ketchikan, Wrangell, and Petersburg. We're governed by the municipal appointed directors. We're financially and legally separated from the munis. Our agency actually absorbed long-term liability assets, and our replacement value of our assets is probably in excess of about $500 million. So when those assets got moved over to SEPA, it kind of freed up our member utilities to do other things. We own two hydroelectric projects, Swan Tyee facilities. We have 175 miles of transmission. We have four submarine cable crossings, which are of great importance for our northern communities. And marine terminal substations and typical things like that. Our wholesale power rate's been 6.8 cents for in excess of 20 years now. And last year we rebated about 2.7 million. And that actually lowered the effective wholesale power rate down to about 5 cents. This year the board's approved an $800,000 rebate. And that would be issued typically at our December meeting. The reason why it's time there is we have to go through our financial audit, make sure there's no extraordinary circumstances that come to light there. I always like to show this slide. It's just of our system for folks that may not be familiar with it. The red line is of importance there. That's the Swan Tyee interconnection that was installed in 2009. The one big thing I like people to just take away from this side is, first of all, is we cover quite a large geographic location, but more importantly, that whole service area has less than 12,000 meters. So as you look to new investment, perhaps a new hydro project or something to the like, you have to cover it under 12,000 meters. So not much. So topics today, I'll cover reservoir levels. That's on everybody's mind. I know I've enjoyed the beautiful weather we have, but unfortunately we've had very, very little inflows into our reservoirs. I'm going to talk about the Tyee Tunnel ROV inspection, and I'll also touch on the submarine cable inspections that we also performed. I'll talk about the Swan Lake O&M transition, ballot measure 1, and the Roadless Rule Advisory Committee as well. So here's a slide for Swan Lake Reservoir. It gives you the various years. And as you can see, that big dark blue line there is going the wrong direction, and it's significantly lower than historically. Part of the reason for that is Ketchikan has been drawing on SEPA resources a little bit harder this year, but obviously is the dry spell as well. Here's Tyee Lake, and as you can see, it's also trending down. We've been selling quite a bit of power south, which is good. We like to maximize use of the hydro resources collectively. We had a meeting today and actually talked about suspending sales out of Tyee to the south until the weather trends start to change. Tyee is a higher reservoir. It tends to get locked up and we meet earlier. And what we mean by that is it tends to freeze up earlier. And when we get precipitation a little bit later in the year, it tends to come in as snow instead of filling up the reservoir. So we want to ensure that the northern communities have access to their dedicated resource, and we don't cut you short. It's kind of this balancing act that SEPA has to do. We try to maximize sales and value to all the member utilities, but at the same time try to ensure that you guys have your dedicated resource. The benefits of selling a lot of power to Ketchikan, for instance, in 2017, we actually sold about $9.5 million in equivalent of diesel generation that Ketchikan KPU would have had to burn. So that would be calculated at 30 cents for diesel, just roughly. You know, price of diesel fluctuates a bit, but so there are significant savings for Ketchikan, but at the same time, it brings in additional revenues for SEPA, which allows us to pursue our robust capital improvements program, which obviously benefits you folks too. So we'll talk about a couple of the little things that we're doing this year that particularly of interest to the northern communities. So we just wrapped this up just a couple of days ago. It was quite the effort. We, on the Taiyi project, is a what we call a lake tap. They drill in through the mountain and go up and tap into the bottom of the lake. There's no dam, so you're using this natural reservoir. And they had some initial problems when they first drained the tunnel 35 years ago when it was put in service, and then it hasn't been drained since. They had a little bit of a tunnel collapse when they did drain it the first time. After we've been researching this quite heavily and did a full assessment, we feel that perhaps they may have drained the tunnel in a certain section a little too fast. That pressure gets up into the rock, and if you take the tunnel and empty it real quick, it wants to push that back out. And we believe that may have happened in a couple of sections due to the speed of draining. Some of the diameters inside the tunnel are different, so if you just drain the whole thing at the same rate, certain sections would drain faster than others.
So is that based on atmospheric pressure?
Or? As the water pressure gets pushed in there, you know, that head pressure,
yep,
from the reservoir gets pressed down, and the head applies pressure up into the rock.
And so is the bronze thing, the actual unit?
So in this picture, the kind of dirty yellow color there behind says Hibbard Insure, behind the guy with the blue shirt. That is the ROV. And the cylindrical portion that they're putting in it, that's the battery pack. This is a really sophisticated piece of equipment. That battery pack also actually weighs 1,200 pounds. And they have the ability to monitor each individual cell in the batteries, and if one starts to go flaky on them, they can actually disconnect it so it doesn't impact the rest of the battery pack when it's down in there. Pretty cool stuff. So this is, they're setting it up. Just to install the battery is a 12-hour project. And they've got to ship it all separately. And of course, then for folks that aren't familiar with Taiyi, the intake for Taiyi is up on the edge of a cliff up above the lake and is accessible only by helicopter. So you're really limited, first of all, on the weights that you can carry with the helicopter. And then once you get it, then they're obviously got to move it around and do stuff with it too. So it was quite the effort to get this done. I had a couple of my managers that lived out there for the better part of a week. So this is up at Taiyi. And they're just getting ready to start sticking it down the shaft. So there's the way this works is the lake tap comes in underneath the lake, and then there's this intake shaft that goes down and intercepts that. And we'll talk about that just a little bit more here. If you see that big yellow spool behind that guy, that's the fiber optic cable. This is a tethered machine, and it'll go for over a mile down the shaft. And the ROV, even though it weighs, when it's together, about 1,600 pounds, it's actually neutral buoyant. It's got some special blocks in there to try to maintain neutral buoyancy. It also has, I believe, six thrusters on it. And it's does sonar and radar, takes three-dimensional imaging as you're going down and records it. So this is hanging on end. They had 1 inch of clearance between the crane just to get it into the hole. So this thing, they actually had to cut like a foot and a half off of the ROV and customize it for our application. And then they took parts that they had to cut off on that, and they actually attached them on the sides and kind of look like a hammerhead shark. So this vertical shaft, first of all, they got lowered about 213 feet down the vertical shaft. And then once they get down that distance, then they have to go in through this gate slot, which is really, really skinny, as you can see. And the ROV, just for general, just a feel how long it is, like 12 feet long. And so they got to stick it down in this little gate slot. And then the gate slot goes another 128 feet. And so they spent, several days just getting it put together, flying all the parts and pieces up there, finalizing the assembly, and then getting it down to the lower part where you can even get it into the shaft to start the inspection. So then the rock tunnel extends for about 7,600 feet, goes almost that depth as well. And then so when they actually flew the ROV down there, it was 4 hours to the end of the tunnel and then 4 hours back.
So that tunnel is 7,600 feet?
The rock tunnel is, yeah.
Under the surface of the earth.
Yeah. And then it comes down by tidewater and comes out of the side of the mountain there. And if you've ever been out to Taiyi, the power plant's just plastered right onto the side of the mountain. But this is a great project because you have a lot of head. It's a very valuable project. Here's another picture. You can see the guys all geared up there. Imagine the shaft down there, a couple hundred feet underground. It's cold, it's wet, it's dark. It's not a pleasant job, but really a cool project. This project, and there's only a couple of outfits that do this in the whole world. These guys actually, their last job they were on was from Guatemala. And they just flew it and barged it over to where our project was at, and had to reconfigure it. There they rappelled down 600 feet down the shaft in order to start. And then we're standing in waist deep water to do the inspection there at in Guatemala. So they do some really custom stuff. But this was I think deeper and further than they've gone before. So. This is pretty cutting-edge stuff, and I think it was 400 feet deeper than the actual design criteria for the ROV itself. And this is the control center that they set up just up at the top of the gate shaft. And then they monitor it, and they have one guy that flies it, another guy, and of course, other guys monitoring it and trying to make assessments as they go as well. And if they see something, they stop and look. So the good part of this is, generally the tunnel's in good condition, and we were unsure what we were going to find. Nobody's looked at it for 35 years, and especially when there was some initial spalling of rock. They did find what appears to be 3 rock slide areas, and I say preliminary tunnel ROV findings. This is really preliminary. I mean, this just happened, so this is some feedback I'm getting from the guys out in the field. They found some debris piles where potentially there was some spalling. Nobody knows when it happened. Heck, it could have happened 35 years ago. So, and then they found one pretty good-sized boulder. At the very end of the tunnel, there's a rock trap there. It's a low depression there. It's designed to pick up any rocks before it transitions into a steel penstock. And there weren't any rocks in that, and they just mostly found that it would appear to be some mud in that area.
So how do they sort out whether it's a rock slide area or a boulder? I mean, a boulder is not going to stop that ROV, or what tells them that there's a boulder there?
So that's a pretty big, good-sized tunnel, right? 12 feet in diameter, depending on where you're at. Okay. And they were able to fly over it, but just imagine 3D imagery. But the visibility, actually, I mean, it's you can only see 6 inches or a foot or something underneath the water, but just sophisticated sonar and radar as they're moving.
So that's what it is. Sonar and radar is just kind of identifying an object.
Yeah. Just think of your fish finder, right?
Yep.
If you have a really high-quality fish finder, the definition that you can see, kind of similar to that. I think they have... I think they had a total of 12 sensors on the ROV. So they're taking a pile of data with different instrumentation as they're going down.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Pretty neat project. More importantly, though, why we wanted to do it is we wanted to do a kind of a risk assessment. You know, what is our risk for the tunnel? And at some point, we may want to dewater the tunnel and do a physical inspection, but we wanted to make sure, we wanted to see what we had, and if there were a lot of large rock falls in there, then we'd have greater concern. And
so when you say dewater that thing in a physical assessment,
that would mean that you would actually put the stop gate in up at the intake structure, and you would drain the tunnel completely, and then you'd physically walk the tunnel and yeah, it gets pretty interesting. I've been on a few of those. Pretty cool stuff. So I wanted to touch just briefly. We did do a ROV inspection of the submarine cables. This is one of our higher risk areas for the organization. I was able to secure some insurance on those cables last year, which we've never had. If I recall, I think it's up to $5 million. Which is a big deal for us to mitigate that risk. Like the other cables, you know, they've been in the water for 35 years. We have one area that goes down through a 1,200-foot deep slot, and it has over 60 suspensions. So if you kind of figure the topography as you go down through this canyon, it's kind of drooped and looping on these edges. And one thing I was concerned about is over time they might get some scouring as the cable goes over and rubs a little bit, and it could potentially get through the armor coating on the cable. So what we discovered, for the most part, they're in great condition, and we may get another 40, 50 years out of them, which is great news because they're really expensive to replace. And just for folks that aren't familiar, for each crossing, we actually have 4 conductors, so we have 1 spare. So in the event that we do have a failure, we do have the ability to swap over to 1 spare. And for the most part, the conductors are separated as well. So if you have an underwater landslide, which that's what's taken out the GCI cables before, right? Then hopefully you just lose one cable if you really had a bad incident underwater. So no signs of pending failure. We still need to dive some of the close to shore areas. They had a specialized boat. They had a mob up with specialized equipment, totally different equipment from what we dove the tunnel with. Because you had to go down 1,200 feet. You had to be sustained within currents, 5.7 knots or something, and be able to hold on top of the cables. So they couldn't reach the real close spots in. And so we're probably going to have to circle back and assemble a contract to do the diving for those areas and document what those are. Those are also a higher risk area because they're typically a little shallower and more susceptible to maybe some scouring or maybe anchors or fishing gear and stuff like that, pots and things like that. So we're still working on that. Haven't got the final report on that, and I expect that the areas that they identified that maybe had some rubs and things, that they'll snip that footage out of there and really highlight those areas. And I have not seen that stuff yet, but we're hoping to get that soon. So moving on to a different topic. Any questions on the stuff I covered before?
Okay. On both sides of the underwater cable that goes from one island to the other, is there did you call that a switching?
So we have what we call marine terminals.
Okay.
Then they come up out, they transition up, and these are oil-filled cables. So we have sensors and stuff that monitor the oil pressures, and we have a day tank and all that stuff to maintain pressures, and some other feedback and some comms and things to get information from those sites.
Thank you.
Sure. So Swan Lake Transition, in case you haven't heard, the Ketchikan City Council unanimously voted to begin transition of Swan Lake O&M over to Swan Lake. As you recall, we did this a few years back with Tyee. I think everybody's been satisfied with how that's proceeded and all the work that's getting done out at Tyee. And so my next task here that I've already started, I've put up a couple of bullets here. So we've met with the employees out at Swan Lake and also have met with the IBEW because these folks coming from Swan Lake will come in under the Tyee agreement, and they're not synchronized right now. And that's one of the advantages of us taking over O&M is we can synchronize the two plants, everything from the labor contracts, training, safety, procedures, and all that. So we'll be able to get both plants up to industry best practices. And so we've also met with the KPU management team as well. And we're putting together essentially a transition document with Tyee. We had several items that we had to do, transfer and assume contracts and things like that. So there'll probably be some other topics that we have to address on this one too, that such as pole attachment agreements. We've got some 137 poles that when we transition from the cross country stuff when we come into town to the Bailey station there. We actually own the poles and are on the overhead, and there's a bunch of underbuild on that. We're also considering some options maybe to move that line of demarcation a little further out to where we come in from the cross country to make things a little cleaner. So that's one of the topics we'll be talking about as well. And we're kind of targeting end of year. That would be a convenient time to do it with payroll and some other things there. So. But it could happen earlier. Another topic, ballot measure number one. And so I've given information to my board on this, and I don't know if you guys are tracking it, and I've tried to encourage folks to get educated on this ballot measure. It is especially harmful to marine-based communities in what it will cost you more to do business at the end of the day. But for today's purposes, I'll speak to how it affects energy. First of all, the ballot measure itself is very deceiving. And one of my fears is that when people read the ballot measure, they're going to come to this conclusion, either save salmon or kill salmon. And the fact of the matter is the protective measures for salmon are very robust in our state. And everything in this particular ballot measure will do nothing to enhance salmon fisheries. But it will increase costs for developing renewable energy projects. When we go to relicense our projects, we'll be subjected to this. Even though it says people will be grandfathered in, we're going to be relicensing Tyee and Swan Lake in 2030 and 31. And that's about a 7-year process and probably $3 to $5 million. This will add additional cost and studies and permitting on top of the robust process that FERC already does. So it's duplicative in nature. And then permitting and access to electrical infrastructure, for instance, on our transmission lines. If you have to cross any body of water or go anywhere near any fresh water, this measure is going to impact that. And so I just encourage folks to take some time and learn, read the fine print. The actual language on the initiative that was submitted to the state and went to the Supreme Court, if you look into the details of that, it kind of layers, it references other statutes, and it gets really complicated for the average person. But please get educated on this, and I'm encouraging people to reach out to five friends and educate them and encourage them to reach out to five friends. When these type of initiatives get on the ballot, they're very hard to get folks educated on. And I'm not telling people how to vote, but at least understand what you're voting on.
I have a question.
Sure.
Mr. Mayor.
Of course. No need. Go ahead.
So, I appreciate this. I spent last week down at Southeast Conference, and I heard this. you know, throughout the conference. And, you know, I understand what people are saying and stuff, but, you know, I think people are concerned about the environment.
So are we.
Yeah, I understand that. But, you know, like a statement like especially harmful to marine-based economy, what does that really mean to Petersburg, which is a marine-based
economy? Sure. So I think it's more impactful to Southeast in particular because we do a lot of stuff that's by the water and fisheries. So, I mean, if you're inland, it'll affect you different. But so, for an example, say I own a piece of remote property on a lake somewhere. And, boy, I'd really like to have some place to tie my plane up when I come in. I'd like to put in a small dock. This initiative or ballot measure now would require me to go out and prove that there's no anadromous fish in that lake if it's not currently on the inventory of lakes. And so I think it lacks some common sense. It gives the impression that this is going to do something to help salmon fisheries, but there is nothing actually science-based in this ballot measure that will improve fisheries.
Okay.
So that's just one example. So getting back to Southeast more directly to your question, I just think there's more opportunities where, in specific, the hydro is what I'm talking about, too, is that, you know, it's clearly going to cost us more to do business, and we're going to have to do more studies. And so when this was originally HB 199, Representative Stutz out of Kodiak sponsored the bill, our group met with her. And we discussed this particular measure, and we said, hey, we've already got a robust process for hydro development. Can you do a carve-out for hydro? I mean, we've got the FERC process. We have to follow it. You know, and like I say, for relicensing, we're going to spend 7 years relicensing a project. We're going to do a tremendous amount of studies. So this does nothing to improve that. It just increases the cost of doing business, which then gets passed on to the ratepayers.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. But you know, this afternoon, I read an article about a mining project that's going on in the interior that is in the process of, if not going bankrupt, not being able to deal with the environmental concerns that they promised to deal with if things didn't go well. And so, you know, what's going to be important for me is to find out what ballot measure one means to Petersburg. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there are certain hydroelectric projects that we want to do in the future that this ballot measure is not going to let us do, then I think we need to look at that. But if there are some concerns, you know, we've had a pretty bad salmon season here. You know, the Stikine is kind of the lifeblood of Petersburg and Wrangell. And if there are mining issues that are going on up in the interior that affect Petersburg, I mean, I think this is all part of the conversation that needs to happen and at least go on for the next couple of weeks, I think.
Yeah, I agree. We're hypersensitive about it because, you know, fisheries are the lifeblood to our community. So I think from a hydro perspective, actually many hydro projects that are developed in Alaska actually enhance fisheries. And as I understand it, this bill would actually inhibit hatcheries being developed. From my understanding, that's the case. So hatcheries may not go forward. And I think when I was reading through it, and I read through it several times and tried to do a sectional analysis, what scared me is what it didn't say. It was very vague. And it's kind of delegated a lot of power to make decisions. So what it does is it causes further uncertainty when you go to develop a project. When you're going forward with it, so I think the regulations are already there for mining. We have a robust mining regulatory process in the state, but one of the best in the world. And they tried to do a one size fits all, sure, trying to stop a couple maybe of the big mines up north. If you look at some of the people that originally supported this, it was It was against Pebble Mine. And I think we're just kind of collateral damage in there, so we just need to be careful. If there's some particular things that need to be fixed, let's be a little bit more surgical on how we go about fixing those. That would be my preference.
Nope. Thank you.
Of course. Yeah.
So, another topic, Roadless Rule Advisory Committee. I just wanted to extend my thanks for you guys expediting a letter of support. I actually had an interview with the committee, the group that's vetting committee members last Friday, and I was able to get letters of support from Southeast Conference, Alaska Energy Authority, all of our three member communities, AELMP up in Juneau, and Alaska Power Association, if I hadn't mentioned that. So all the major players in the energy arena in Alaska, most of the major ones, and our local folks have helped support me on this. And this is a big deal for folks that have been watching this go on for, I don't know, 17 years or something now. SEPA's been heavily engaged in this process since I've been on board. And, you know, we filed amicus briefs with the state, and we tried to work toward some type of an exemption. I also worked with the Forest Service to see if we could tweak the language in the Tongass Forest Plan, just to make things a little bit more flexible and not so rigid. And just a simple example, if they were requiring you to go down this transmission line corridor, and maybe if you move that corridor over a half a mile or something, maybe it saves the project a couple million dollars. There's got to be some reasonableness to it when in some cost considerations when you go to do that stuff. So hopefully I get selected and look forward, if I do, to at least giving the committee. It's going to be 13 members, you know, at least the perspective from energy development. And, you know, I look at energy development in the Tongass and the Chugach for that matter. Affordable energy is the cornerstone of economic development, and most of this effort related to developing the state-specific roadless rule is looking strongly at economic development for small communities around Southeast. And so I think it's important that we have an energy seat on there. When they first issued the original MOU, there was no reference to energy. I think it was an oversight, but through some talks with folks that were involved in it, we are actually able to get energy put in and recognized when they put out the administrative order.
I have a question.
Of course.
So can you tell me the difference between the state-specific roadless rule and the roadless rule?
Sure.
What will it enable us to do as opposed to stop us from doing?
So this is an opportunity to get feedback from the stakeholders on the ground, and this committee of 13 folks is going to be really diverse. It's going to have environmental groups, fisheries groups, forest people, and some other agencies and committees. There's going to be an opportunity for those folks to weigh in on and try to give some recommendations on how to tweak things to make the existing rule. And where this comes from is Idaho and Colorado, when the roadless rule first came out several years ago, they actually did state-specific rules that accommodated their state. So this will give us an opportunity to perhaps modify the roadless rule while still maintaining most of the intent and integrity for what they were trying to achieve, but also taking into account the local communities, sustainability of those communities, opportunities for economic development, energy development. There'll be tourist representatives on this as well. So, I mean, I know down where I'm at, some of the tourist folks there are like, we're having a difficulty getting perhaps a lease or something to do some shore excursions or something of that nature. So I think there's you know, the Tongass should be have multiple uses and then try to find that balance. Yeah. So that's where I'm hoping. We'll see where it goes, right?
Yeah.
Because sometimes these committees don't advance things, and obviously it's been going on for 17 years. But I think this is a new kind of a unique opportunity. But don't forget, there's three things currently going on still, right? So there's a full exemption that's currently in the Farm Bill at the federal level, and then it's still challenged in the courts, and then this will be the third process. So maybe through those three processes, we'll get somewhere.
So just to understand, the state-specific rule makes it easier for us statewide to deal with projects that we're hoping to do in the Tongass or Alaska?
Yeah, specifically in the roadless rule.
Okay.
Under the inventory roadless rule, yeah.
All right, thank you very much.
So this is pretty fast-tracked. Supposed to present an initial report by November 30th. So, and then the report may include up to three options, and then that'll roll through that process, and then maybe over the next 18 months or 2 years, we'll try to get something wrapped around that. And then you guys have probably seen too that the Forest Service has opened up rulemaking, and they're also kind of running a parallel process on this to develop a new EIS. And of course, all this has got to feed back into the how the forest plan is administered too. But I see that this is a nice window that's been created from our federal delegation to perhaps make some positive changes. Great. So once again, thanks for your support. I really do appreciate that.
Of course. I just want to say thanks for coming here. I know you were down in the Southeast Conference last week. We ran into each other a couple times, and you know, you're doing a great job for Petersburg and Wrangell and Ketchikan, but I appreciate your time and effort away from your family and all the rest of the stuff, but I appreciate all the time.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you.
Any other questions for Trey? As Member Mucci said, thanks very much. We appreciate your effort, sir.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, of course. Always welcome. As Trey gets his stuff put away, we're going to transition right into Community and Economic Development. Director Cabrera is going to give us a presentation. Tonight is presentation night. So Liz Cabrera is preparing to speak, getting her own laptop and such set up.
It'll take a minute here.
Let's take a minute or two, so.
Yeah.
There you go.
I think I'm just going to try and do exactly what you did.
It worked pretty good, actually.
Joe, we'll call this halftime. Would you like here to provide us some entertainment while she's getting set up?
Do you want this
yeah,
or do
you of course.
Yeah,
this one.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't have an HDMI.
Oh, you did.
I got the mini HDMI.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Liz is just about set. Get yourself dialed in.
Play
by play. You know, it's football season. We want to give a play by play from up here, too, you know?
Let's see.
And for those listening at home, Director Cabrera is going to give us a presentation of the Draft Development Code.
I can make this, do this as seamlessly as Trey just did. Okay. Hi, Liz Cabrera, Community and Economic Development, and I'm going to give you a brief presentation on where we are at with the development code revision, and specifically the what, why, how, and when, more or less where we're at now and where we're going to be heading in the next few months, hopefully. So, to get started, let's get us all on the same page, which is, what is a development code? And basically, it's the part of the municipal code that regulates land use, land division, and all development within the borough, especially in service area one. Currently, we have two titles in our code. One is called zoning, and the other one is called subdivision. And they basically regulate all land use in service area one only. And we have that authority to regulate land use through the Alaska Constitution and the Borough Charter and Alaska Statute. So why do this? There's a couple of main reasons. One of them is our current code was adopted in 1985 and then subsequently amended many times throughout the years. And what it's resulted in is a code that has a lot of internal conflicts and missing definitions, missing pieces, different types of processes, depending on the type of permit you're doing, which don't really make any sense. A lot of outdated definitions, a lot of definitions of things that are happening now in land use that don't exist in there. So it's very difficult for us to enforce a code that is really outdated and self-contradictory. And then the second reason is when we adopted a comprehensive plan in 2016, the land use chapter in that plan had very specific recommendations, such as improve your code, because you're having a really hard time implementing it and enforcing it, and had some very specific suggestions on how we should do that. And just as a reminder, that comprehensive plan process, it was a year and a half process, lots of public meetings, lots of public input. So that's basically the foundation that we're building this code revision off of. We're taking the recommendations from that comp plan and implementing them in this revision. So I want to emphasize that because it's not just something that out of the blue we just decided to do all these things. We actually had a basis for a lot of the policy decisions that are in this revision. How's it being revised? So what we're proposing is it's called a unified development code. So instead of having one chapter that only deals with zoning and one chapter that only deals with subdivision, we're going to put those together and make one development code. And the pluses, you know, just a couple of examples of why that's a good idea, is then all your definitions are consistent across both titles, which we don't have right now. All your processes are the same. So from my side of things, on the administrative side, I know that no matter what kind of permit I'm issuing, no matter what kind of land division or anything that we're reviewing at the Planning Commission, it's always going to be, these people are noticed this number of days before the meeting, we have to put out public notices here, here, and here. And it's always going to be the same, regardless. So for me, that's great compared to, okay, for this process, you wait 30 days, and then you can have the meeting. For this one, have a meeting, and then have a second meeting, and then you can make the decision. On this other one, one meeting, notice is 15 days, these people are mailed. Oh, on this one, these other people are mailed. So just in terms of streamlining how we provide public notice, it's completely an improvement. Also, we didn't create this code from scratch. It's actually based on a model code that's used in many small communities in Oregon. So they have it, a lot of them have it exactly as in the model. We've made a lot of tweaks because we're not as, I would say, heavy-handed in how we do zoning here. So I've taken a lot of things out that they use in Oregon. And then lastly, just how it actually does get approved, it has to be by ordinance by the Borough Assembly. I don't know why this does this. But so what have we done to date? I think I included in your packets kind of a spreadsheet of all the public outreach we've done so far. And specifically, the Planning Commission has had four public hearings, and they considered 20 amendments in their last meeting before making a recommendation to the Assembly. And those amendments, some were from the Commission itself, some were from the public, and some just came from staff. After the Planning Commission finished its amendments and made a recommendation. Then it went to the borough attorney, and the borough attorney has reviewed everything and renumbered every page and made sure all the colons and commas and everything are as they should be. So one of the concerns is this is a lot of information. And yes, it's a lot of information, no doubt about it. And so I'm going to give you my handy tips on how to actually learn about the code without having to necessarily read the entire code book. So one recommendation is I gave you, and these documents are also all available on the borough's webpage, so if anyone wants to get them, they can, and we have copies as well. But there's a series of one-page summaries, and it links the goal and the comp plan to how it's implemented in the code. So you can see, oh, we have a housing goal of trying to provide more affordable housing, especially in the downtown area. And then there's a series of five ways of how the code is meeting that goal. So that's kind of a big picture view of what's new in the code. There's also a series of current code versus new code sheets. And so let's say you're currently in single family residential. The district in the new code that is closest or corresponds the most to that is called low density residential. So this sheet just gives you a comparison of the two, and it's both the lot development standards, which are things like the minimum square foot and the setbacks, how much of a lot you can cover between the current code and the new code. And then it goes through all the allowable uses in the current code and under the new code. And we highlight where there's any differences between the two. So you can see this is what we have now, and this is what we would have under the new code. And so it goes through that for the different types of residential districts, the industrial district, and the commercial district. So once folks have a sense of what code they might be in, it's a really good resource to understand where you are now and what it would be under the new code. There's also online a preliminary map. And this map hasn't been reviewed yet by the Planning Commission, so it's preliminary draft to the nth degree. I think one thing you'll notice is, and I'll talk more about this in a minute, but a lot of the boundaries that we currently have in our zoning, you know, where residential areas are, where commercial areas are, industrial, those really do not change. So I think a lot of people really get hung up with the map, but the fundamental changes are really going to be in the code. And so I can't stress enough that really where you want to look for changes is in the code, not necessarily in the boundaries and the colors of the map. The map is a good reference point, but again, you know, you really want to look at the code behind that map.
So, sir, of the course. Code as in?
The proposed development code, okay. The book that I gave you. Okay. So even if you're looking at those one-page sheets,
yes.
You know, don't get so hung up on the lines on the map, okay. And understand that really where the change is actually in the underlying code.
Sure.
Okay. And then if you want to stay up to date with where we're at and what's going on, you can sign up for an email newsletter. I think we're on number 7, which goes out tomorrow. And each one of those newsletters has focused on a different topic in the development code, and it also lists upcoming hearings and directs you to the website also for more information. And if you signed up and you're not getting it, I would say check your spam folder, because that's where mine always ends up, and I'm the one that sent it, so however that works. So at this point, the next step would be to adopt the code by ordinance, and at your next meeting, I'll have a proposed schedule for adoption. This is something of a chicken and the egg thing, because you have to adopt the code and then adopt the map, because if you adopt the code with no map, then you can't really implement it. If you adopt a map with no code, then that doesn't work either. So, and there's a lot of public notice requirements that go along with this, and so I have to sit down with the attorney to make sure that we're meeting our public notice requirements and also creating a process that actually works together well and actually gets us to an endpoint where we have a map and a code at a certain time that's both enforceable all at the same time. So hopefully by the next meeting, I'll have that. And at this point, and certainly feel free to weigh an opinion, but I would think that at least two public hearings at the assembly would be appropriate for the ordinance, not just the one, but it is a big topic, and I think it's worth giving folks more than one shot at coming in to talk to you about it. So that's sort of what I'm thinking at the moment. And maybe try to make it one daytime one and one evening one. And then just to briefly show you the, from that borough website, you can either go to this online zoning map, or there's also ones you can download as PDF. But this one is actually pretty slick because, and hopefully it'll work, it has a little story that it tells as you go along, so you can understand why we're changing. But then, it already clicked off, sorry. Make this work. It's more sensitive than I am. So you can zoom in and click on any lot, and it'll actually tell you what your zoning, current zoning is, and what your proposed zoning is. And that's for all in service area one. So you can zoom in, make sure it's the lot that you own, and then check out what your proposed zoning is. And then if you continue down, it actually goes through and highlights some of the more significant changes that we're proposing. And I'll just give you an example. Almost everything that's single family residential currently is going to be moved into its corresponding district, which is low density residential. And there's one exception. And here's kind of the narrative on it, talking about how we're moving everything in except for this area in downtown that we're moving into medium density. And then if you click on the last sentence there, it actually just highlights that one area. And then if you continue down, so then areas zoned as single family mobile home, multifamily, and mobile home are all moved into high density. And then if you click there, it highlights those areas that are going to be proposed to be rezoned as high density. So then whatever type of zoning you're interested in, you can go down into the industrial areas. And again, most areas that are currently industrial continue to be zoned industrial. I think I have one exception here, which is in Scow Bay, a light industrial area. And if you click on it, you can see these are those LI areas are currently industrial, but we're proposing zoning them into light industrial. And this is that Scow Bay Loop Road, which is predominantly residential right now, with a few warehouses. Light industrial really lends itself to that kind of mixed use. And then here's that area north of where the Reeds property, what Silver Bay owns now, also kind of heavily residential. It still allows for warehouses and things like that, and some light industrial uses like welding and light manufacturing, but it keeps out things like asphalt plants and a seafood processing plant unless you go through a conditional use process. So it basically offers some protection for those residential uses, but doesn't really necessarily keep out most industrial uses, except it does keep out some of those really high impact ones. And then just looking in an effort to add a little bit more industrial land into our land base, these areas here were all either unzoned or in development reserve or non-development status. So you couldn't develop them until you actually put them into some type of zoning district the way our current code is written. So putting them into industrial in this area, and then also up here, which is private land and also mental health trust land next to the rock pit, moving that into industrial land. So that makes it available for development without actually having to go through a whole rezone process for the developer. Yeah.
Of course, yeah, you're free.
So I, on this map currently, one of my properties is zoned industrial but has residential lots on it, and it says that I'm assuming I'd be grandfathered in, but then for resale value, would I be able to, I mean, would, could you not do improvements? Could you not reconstruct? I mean, how would that work?
So we have a whole non-conforming section of the code. Mm-hmm. If you're a non-conforming use, for instance, you're currently a residential in an industrial district, mm-hmm. the way our current code is, it's really difficult to expand that. Under the new code, you can expand it by, I think it's 50% over the existing size. If it gets destroyed, you can rebuild to the previous size. So we've tried to be really liberal on the non-conforming, mostly because we want to make sure that especially the residential uses in those industrial lands, because we know there's quite a bit of that, that people will be able to rebuild what they have, you know, without a hassle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I have to say the attorney and I spent a crazy amount of time trying to make sure that actually worked that way, so. And I almost had her, and I think I still will actually write it down so that we don't forget how it's exactly supposed to work in plain English as opposed to in code language. And just another notable thing, most of the land outside of our downtown core and kind of our water, along the water down the Narrows, was unzoned. So what I'm proposing here is to put a lot of the land that we currently have requested from the state and expect to have conveyed to us, putting that into this development reserve status, which is kind of a holding district. It also has the added advantage of kind of putting on hold on anything as if the state wanted to do something with it. You wouldn't really be able to develop it until you zoned it into something. So it offers us a little bit of protection on that land if it takes a really long time to get it conveyed. Until we decide how we want to see it used. And the exceptions to that are these two big chunks here, which are part of the Southeast State Forest, and I just went ahead and put them into industrial, knowing that, you know, development is already set to go there. So we know that already. So those are in industrial. Everything else is in that development reserve. And then just one more, bear with me, highlight, which is open space. And this is just in case somebody notices why. These kind of squiggly greens are, one is Hammer Slough and the other one is Mill Slough. Those are Petersburg Borough owned lots. They were zoned, you know, commercial, single family, residential, what have you. They're pretty much in the middle of the creeks. So made it a strong assumption that the borough was not gonna develop in the middle of Hammer Slough or in the middle of Mill Slough. And so we made these open space, and it kind of creates a nice little area that, you know, kind of looks like it's walkable, it's open, you know, there's a scenic value to it, and you're trying to recognize that scenic value that we, especially on Hammer Slough, that we all currently value, but just to do a little bit more to recognize that in our code. And that's pretty much it. And hard copies of the code will be at the library here. They're online, the map's online, you can download the PDFs online, and also the code's online, so.
Thank you, Director Cabrera. Just a quick thought of my own is one thing that, I mean, I've read all of it and it is exhaustive.
It
really is. There's no way around it. I really like the one-page summaries you kind of put together for people, like Cliff Notes, as they used to be called, to kind of point you in the right direction. I really encourage people to hop online, watching Liz's presentation here. It helps to see it. Helps to see it visually, I think, especially with the map. I know a lot of work and public input has been put into this, so thank you for that, Director Cabrera. Any other questions for Liz? Member Mucci.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. No, I just want to thank Liz and Molly for putting all this stuff together, all the maps, you know, and especially the Planning and Zoning Committee. I mean, I sat in on a couple of the meetings last year, you know, Chris Fry, Dave Kinzinger, Sally Dreyer, Richard Burke, Tor Benson, Otis Marsh, Yancey Nielsen. They spent a lot of time, listened to a lot of testimony that was going on from contractors and individuals around town just about making this document work. You know, I'm hoping that we can have this on the October 1st agenda just to kind of get it moving, you know. And I guess one of the questions I have, and I'm sure I'm going to be asked, is if people don't like the document, how do they suggest changes to some of this stuff?
Well, I'll tell you what we did at the Planning Commission, and it worked really well, and it's probably what I'm going to suggest for the Assembly as well, is to, you know, go through your public hearing process, have a couple of public hearings, and encourage people to submit amendments, and yourselves as well. I mean, I had the same thing with the Planning Commission. So if you see something that you don't agree with or you don't think is right, you may not know immediately how to fix it, but if you give us an idea of what you're trying to do, we can work with you to come up with an amendment. It may not be perfect. We'll get it to the attorney. We'll, you know, eventually we'll work it in there. At the last meeting the Planning Commission had, we basically made a list of all the amendments, went through each one, voted on it, at the end moved the document forward. I went through back and added all their amendments into the bigger document, and that's what ended up getting sent to the attorney. That way, everyone's amendment was vetted, was heard, was commented on. The commission considered it. Some amendments passed and some didn't. Some got changed and adopted. So it was a good process. And, you know, it took them a few hours to go through 20 amendments. So, but it was a fair process because everyone could submit what they wanted to. So,
thank you.
Yeah. Anything else for Director Cabrera? Thank you so much, Liz. Really appreciate it.
Sure.